10 days ago, we had the fortune of going up to the Galilee, to Akko and Nahalia, on behalf of the National Council of Young Israel, to distribute food and other goods, as well as 150 fans, towards the new immigrant place up in Nahalia, where it's awfully hot and muggy. At that point, we gave away 150 fans. We went to Batei Tamchui, and as I said, we had the fortune of having Mrs. Pollard, Rav Pesach Lerner of the National Council of Young Israel, and the correspondent of Ahud Sheva paper in Russian, whose name is Eleanor Shifrin, who is with us here this evening as well. Now, the reason I'm telling you that is we also had a group of about 10-12 girls who were mostly from Mamlachti Dati in Ulpana, who helped us along to distribute those goods. And to our amazement, those girls who go either to Mamlachti Dati or to Openers knew very, very little about Jonathan Pollard, who has been incarcerated over almost 22 years at this point. Without any further introduction, I'll give you Esther Pollard to tell her, to actually give us a talk, and the title of it this evening is Jonathan and the Judge, a final chapter in the Pollard case with a question mark. So, Mrs. Esther Pollard.
Hear me? No? Okay. I'm going to be over here, so how do we do this? Maybe.
As close as possible. She met the thing.
Okay. Can everyone hear? Can anyone hear? We may end up having to do without the mic, because it may just be a distraction. I need it lower. Okay.
I'll tell you, we're holding your hand.
I need my hands to move my papers.
That's all right. We'll hold up for a minute, that's all.
All right, we'll try this and see how it works. Okay. First of all, it's a pleasure to be here tonight. In 21 years that my husband's been in prison, this is the first time I was invited to speak here, so I must tell you that we're very happy to be here tonight. I want to express, on behalf of Jonathan and myself, our gratitude to the National Council of Young Israel, the only Jewish organization in America that cares at all about the mitzvah Pidyon Shvuim. Our experience has been that everyone else knows Diburim Yafim Bli Ma'asim. The National Council of Young Israel is the only organization that has stood with us throughout this horrible ordeal the whole 21 years. I also want to thank Moshe Leshinsky, past president of Beit Knesset HaNasi, the current president and the board of Beit Knesset HaNasi, for inviting me here tonight. Thank you all for coming. Normally, we're all mishpacha here. Normally, I prefer to a small and friendly crowd like this. Normally, I prefer not to have a text and to speak from the heart. But I decided not to do that tonight. I rarely speak in public anymore. It's 21 years that this saga has been going on. And after 21 years, if every congregation in this country or in America is still waiting for Esther Pollard to come and tell them what's going on, it's really too late. However, when Moshe asked me to speak, I knew that this was something special. And because it's 21 years, I prepared a formal text because the subject is that important. I don't want you to miss anything. So I'm going to start by telling you a story. Hence the title of my speech, Jonathan and the Judge. On a sunny winter day, early in the new year, 2006, one of the most historic meetings on this case took place here in Jerusalem. Jonathan and I have never breathed a word about our meeting with Israel State Controller, Judge Micha Lindenstrauss. Tonight, we'd like to share that experience with you. For years, Jonathan has appealed to one state controller after another to investigate the government's mishandling of his case. All of his appeals were rejected with flimsy excuses. Consequently, we'd pretty much given up any hope of ever getting a meeting with any of Israel's state controllers. That's why it was so exciting when Judge Lindenstrauss responded positively to our request for a meeting. Israel's state controller, also known as the Mevaker HaMedina, has broad powers of oversight and the right to investigate every government office, every government decision, and every government process. No individual or office in this country is exempt from the Mevaker's probe, and all are compelled by law to respond to his questions and to provide whatever information is requested. The ultimate goal of an investigation by the state controller is the publication of a public report. The report is intended to bring to light those areas or issues that need to be rectified with a view to improving government efficiency, safeguarding the interests of the public, protecting the rights of the individual, and eliminating government waste, graft, corruption, and cronyism. Our long-awaited meeting with Judge Lindenstrauss took place on February 23, 2006, at the offices of the Mevaker HaMedina. I was accompanied by Larry Gubb, Jonathan's Jerusalem attorney. As if to underscore the seriousness of the meeting, Judge Lindenstrauss invited his extended executive staff to attend, that is, the heads of every single state office under his auspices, everyone from the state ombudsman to the head of the state legal department, about half a dozen people in all. At the outset of the meeting, I presented Judge Lindenstrauss with a personal message from Jonathan and with a file of documented information regarding all of the issues that Jonathan wanted to call to the judge's attention. Delivering Jonathan's message, this is not going to work. Can we find another place for this? Delivering Jonathan's message took about 15 minutes. It removed any doubt about Jonathan's awareness of the meeting, and it underscored his deep appreciation for the Mevaker's willingness to receive us. It was my job for the next 2 hours to expand on those issues that Jonathan had touched on. I would like to review with you briefly tonight some of the facts that were presented to Judge Lindenstrauss. My husband, Jonathan Pollard, is an Israeli agent in captivity, currently completing his 21st year of a life sentence for his service to the security needs of Israel. The information that Jonathan provided to Israel included Iranian, Iraqi, Libyan, and Syrian nuclear, chemical, and biological warfare capabilities, all being developed for use against Israel. He also provided information on ballistic missile development by these countries and information on upcoming terrorist attacks against civilian targets in Israel. Israel was legally entitled to this vital security information according to a 1983 Memorandum of Understanding signed by both countries. But the information was being deliberately withheld from Israel as a result of an illegal intelligence embargo implemented by former Secretary of Defense Castle Weinberger and former Director Deputy of the CIA, Admiral Bobby Ray Inman, both of whose pro-Arab tilt did not jibe with stated American foreign policy. In the beginning, Jonathan volunteered his services, and only later did he become a bona fide agent on behalf of the State of Israel. His zeal to save Israeli lives was his sole motivation. Even the sentencing judge, who was no friend of the case, recognized that Jonathan was an ideologue, not a mercenary, and therefore declined to impose a monetary fine. From the time that Jonathan was first arrested in 1985, Israel denied all ties to him and cooperated fully with the prosecution to secure a life sentence for Jonathan. For its own shameful reasons, American Jewish leadership endorsed and perpetuated Israel's lies. On March 10, 1987, the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations submitted a letter to the U.S. State Department endorsing Jonathan's life sentence and promising never to intervene on his behalf. The Conference of Presidents has kept that promise religiously for 21 years. How do we know about this letter? My husband received a copy of it in response to a Freedom of Information Act request. It's interesting that this letter that was sent by the conference to the U.S. State Department was sent 6 days after Jonathan was sentenced to a life sentence with no possibility of parole, in complete violation of a plea agreement which Jonathan honored and the government completely abrogated. Despite the passage of 21 years and innumerable opportunities, Israel's lies continue to govern this case and effectively to keep Jonathan in prison. Now, the really shocking thing is that Israel brazenly handed over to the U.S. all of the evidence that was used against Jonathan. Without this evidence, the Americans had no case against Jonathan and would ultimately have been forced to set him free. In betraying Jonathan and by handing over the evidence to be used against him, Israel earned for itself the dishonorable distinction of being the first and only country in the history of modern espionage ever to assist in the indictment and prosecution of its own agent. No country ever did that to its own agent before Jonathan Pollard, and no country has ever done it again since. Israel paid the lawyer who secured a life sentence for Jonathan without benefit of trial. Jonathan never had a trial. And Israel paid for the lawyer who secured a life sentence for him. Think about this, because the sentence that Jonathan was facing without the help of this Israeli paid lawyer was a median sentence of 2 to 4 years. Jonathan got life. This was the same lawyer paid by the government of Israel who failed to file a simple notice of intent to appeal. It had to be filed within 10 days after sentencing. He failed to file a simple notice of intent to appeal and therefore forever deprived Jonathan of his right to appeal his life sentence. By contrast, to this very day, Israel has steadfastly refused to pay a cent to those lawyers, unlike the above-mentioned one, who are actually trying to help Jonathan secure his release from prison. Even though Jonathan fought and succeeded in forcing the State of Israel to officially acknowledge him as her agent, the state's attitude towards him and her abandonment of him has not changed in 21 years. The State of Israel has never taken the most minimal steps, legal, moral, or diplomatic, to secure Jonathan's release. To this day, Israel has never officially, and the operative word here is officially, Israel has never officially informed the White House, the Justice, Intelligence, or State Department that Jonathan is an Israeli agent and that Israel intends to seek his release. Consequently, the American Justice Department regards Jonathan only as a common criminal, not as an Israeli agent, and treats him accordingly, the way you would treat a common criminal. To this day, the State of Israel has never sought the assistance of American congressmen or senators on Jonathan's case, and for two decades, it has calculatedly avoided engaging AIPAC or any other effective lobbying organization on his behalf. In 21 years, Israel has never done any hasbara for the public in Israel. Most of you are hearing about the case for the first time tonight. Moshe Leshinsky pointed out that the young girls that we met with on the trip had never really heard anything about Jonathan, certainly not in any formal way. In 21 years, the government of Israel has never, ever done any hasbara for the public in Israel or in the U.S. to explain its position on Jonathan's case and to promote his release, as it routinely does to explain every other matter of importance to the State of Israel. For 21 years, the State of Israel has deliberately attempted to prevent the Israeli public from knowing about Jonathan. And a good indicator of this is reflected in the Ministry of Education's refusal, abject refusal, to include Jonathan's plight in the regular school curriculum. Hey, you've got an agent in captivity for 21 years. Shouldn't school children know about it? In fact, the Ministry of Education library and its archives, which is the place that teachers go when they do research to present lessons, contains absolutely no information whatsoever about Jonathan. Not a single reference, not a single page, not a single newspaper, nothing. When Jonathan's former handler, Rafi Eitan, ran for Knesset this year, it put the lie to the government's long-standing claim that pressing for Jonathan's release somehow might damage U.S.-Israel relations. Indeed, the government of Israel demonstrated no compunction whatsoever about possible damage to U.S.-Israel relations or to Jonathan's situation when immediately upon his election, it appointed Rafi Eitan to become a minister. Gee, I guess they were really afraid of what the United States might say. I'm being cynical about that. The government's appointment of Eitan as a minister was done with the full knowledge that the Americans regard Eitan as an unindicted co-conspirator, and knowing full well that Eitan had played a key role in the betrayal of Jonathan Pollard, even providing false testimony to the Americans, which 21 years ago doomed Jonathan. From the time that Jonathan was first arrested, the only consistent plan that Israel has ever had for his release is to bring him home in a coffin, God forbid. This fact has been confirmed for us over and over again for the last 21 years by various officials and events. For example, Jonathan miraculously survived the first 7 years of his incarceration in solitary confinement in barbaric conditions in a dungeon cell 3 stories underground at USC Marion, and then waged his own battle without any help from the State of Israel to be moved to open population at FCI Butner. Just shortly after his move to FCI Butner in the spring of 1993, Israel sent a Mossad agent to Jonathan on official business. Instead of presenting Jonathan with a plan for securing his release, the Mossad agent came to Jonathan armed with an official government request that Jonathan kill himself. Committing suicide, Jonathan was told. would solve the power problem, and that's a quote, for the state of Israel. The Israeli policy, which wants to bring Jonathan Pollard home in a coffin, God forbid, continues to this day, and illuminates, it makes understandable, the government's calculated consistency in missing every opportunity to secure Jonathan's release. Instead, successive governments of Israel have routinely exploited Jonathan's name and his plight, using it as a sweetener to sell unpopular unilateral concessions to the Israeli public. But when crunch time comes, Jonathan is always dropped from every deal, and painful unilateral concessions to the enemy are made anyway. Some examples include the Hebron Accords, the Y Accords, and most recently the disengagement from Gaza and northern Shomron. In every case, Jonathan's name was held out to the Israeli public as a possible sweetener. In Washington, it's an open secret that Jonathan's sentence is grossly disproportionate and purely political. This was confirmed in a 2002 interview with former Secretary of Defense, the late Caspar Weinberger. Weinberger openly admitted that Jonathan's case was, quote, a minor matter that had been exaggerated out of all proportion to serve another political agenda. The opening that this admission created was totally ignored by Israel. Similarly, Dennis Ross, the former U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East, stated in his book, The Missing Piece, published in the year 2004, that Jonathan Pollard deserves to be freed unconditionally. Nevertheless, writes Ross, Pollard is too valuable as a bargaining chip against Israel, so he advised the President at Y not to release him. Still no response from Israel. This is part of the public record. This is in Ross's book. In point of fact, Israel has already paid for Jonathan's release several times over, including freeing 750 murderers and terrorists with blood on their hands as part of the Y Accords, but has never bothered to collect Jonathan's release. You know, if you went to the McCulloch and you paid for something, 5 shekels, 10 shekels, and you didn't get it, would you go home and forget about it? Or would you make a fuss? Doesn't make any sense, does it, that Israel has repeatedly paid for Jonathan's release, kaviyachol, but never remembers to actually collect on it? In the 21 years that Jonathan has been in prison, he has been repeatedly subjected to cruel and unusual punishment and severe affliction. The government of Israel has been informed of each and every episode of mistreatment of its agents, but has never once in 21 years protested and never once saw fit to intervene on behalf of its agents. Jonathan's first court appearance, where Jonathan himself was physically present in court for the first time in 2 decades, took place in the year 2003. Israel didn't even bother to send a representative. Instead, on the eve of Jonathan's court hearing, Israel's consular representative in New York, who was given the task of officially responding to the American media, slandered Jonathan on American national television and thus sent a clear message to the judge that Jonathan Pollard is hefker and to do with him whatever you wish. Israel's intent never to bring Jonathan Pollard home alive is reflected in the immoral and mean-spirited way that the state relates to me, his wife. As the wife of an Israeli agent, the fact that I remain homeless and penniless speaks volumes about the state's attitude towards Jonathan. Compare this with the case of a well-known Israeli drug dealer, a family friend of a prime minister, who was taken captive while pursuing his own illicit interests, not in the service of the state of Israel. Both his wife and his mistress and their respective families received full financial support for the duration of his captivity. I, on the other hand, received nothing from the state of Israel, no help whatsoever, and I am dependent for my survival on the kindness of a few good friends. Moreover, I am a cancer survivor. I have no medical insurance, and I receive no medical assistance whatsoever from the state of Israel. In fact, when I recently tried to buy basic medical coverage on my own, I was rejected by Kupat Cholim. The manner in which I was rejected strongly suggested that they were fearful of accepting Paula's wife, that this might somehow interfere with their government funding. Compare this also with the government's recent offer to the citizens of Lebanon. They were offered free medical treatment in Israel in spite of their possible participation in the recent war against Israel. Think about it. Enemy aliens can come here from Lebanon and receive free medical treatment, but the wife of an Israeli agent can't even buy medical treatment here. Worse still, the government brazenly lied to the Supreme Court of Israel and to the Israeli public when it repeatedly claims to be supporting Jonathan and me financially. We presented documented proof to Judge Lindenstrauss that in 21 years, neither Jonathan or I has ever received a cent from the government of Israel. How can they say they want him home when they don't even care about his day-to-day survival, when they don't care about our day-to-day survival? The bottom line is that for 21 years, the state of Israel has stubbornly denied granting Jonathan any status that would bring him or his wife any assistance or any relief or any relief or the possibility of securing his release. Even though Jonathan fought for and obtained official recognition as an agent, his name does not appear on the Ministry of Defense's list of shivoyim, thus depriving him of all of his rights as an agent in captivity. The state also refuses to grant him status as a prisoner of Zion, again depriving him of any rights that accrue, but more importantly, depriving him of all of the protections of that status. By denying Jonathan's status within the official framework governed by the Ministry of Defense as a shavui, as a captive, and denying him status within the framework of the Internal Affairs Ministry as a prisoner of Zion, the State of Israel has relegated Jonathan to the status of a person who officially simply does not exist and can therefore be ignored to death. These facts and all of the pertinent information, documented information, were presented to the Mevaker HaMedina, Judge Micha Lindenstrauss, on that fateful day in February, when after years and years of waiting, a new state controller received us and seemed to embrace the case. The meeting was a great success. It had originally been scheduled to last for 1 hour. It went on for some 2.5 hours before it was reluctantly concluded, and even then, only because we all had other commitments. I went straight from the meeting with the Mevaker HaMedina to report personally to Jonathan's Rav, Kavod Rav Mordechai Eliyahu Shlita. The Rav was as delighted as we were with the reception and the commitment we had gotten from the Mevaker HaMedina. He and all of our closest associates were especially buoyed to hear about the warm wishes and blessings we received from Judge Lindenstrauss and his executive staff. I remember one of the last things I said to Judge Lindenstraub before we said goodbye. I told him, Your Honor, we do not expect you to secure Jonathan's release, but your investigation may be an important part of the process of bringing it about. Your public report has the potential to shine a light on this case that has never before been shone, and in that way, to be a catalyst for Jonathan's freedom. But even if your report results in no direct advantage for Jonathan, it must be written to ensure that what happened to Jonathan never, ever again happens to anyone else who serves the state of Israel. Judge Lindenstraub seems to understand. He responded warmly and reassuringly and promised to investigate. He promised that he and his staff would stay in touch and would contact us if they needed any further information. We were deeply touched by his words of support and encouragement, and by his and his executive staff's warmth and enthusiasm. That was 6 months ago. Just a couple of weeks ago, on August 17th, Jonathan used up a week's worth of his precious telephone minutes to dictate a personal letter to Judge Lindenstraub. In it, Jonathan reiterated the facts that I have shared with you tonight. And then he added, and I quote, Judge Lindenstraub, with the exception of a brief message that we received in March of this year, some 5.5 months ago, from one of your staff, saying that you're investigating, there hasn't been a word from you or your office ever since then. My situation in the meantime continues to deteriorate. Every day that I survive is a complete miracle. May we know the status of your investigation and when you anticipate publishing your findings? Yours truly, Jonathan Pollard. A few days later, on August 23rd, Jonathan and I received a reply. The very brief response was signed by, and I quote, the Senior Assistant to the State Controller and International Liaison, end quote. And this reply echoed virtually the same unmistakable message that we have gotten from Israeli government officials for the last 21 years. The matter is being dealt with. Don't call us. We'll call you. I am sharing this with you tonight because it is anecdotally representative of the last 21 years that Jonathan has been slowly bleeding to death in prison, in full view of the State of Israel and its elected and appointed officials, and in full view of the Jewish people. Why does it matter that my husband continues to languish in prison after 21 years in some of the harshest conditions? Why should the fate of one individual be of concern to anyone, especially when so much time has gone by, and especially when there seem to be so many more pressing problems, such as the impending threat of another war, or the fate of Israel's latest 3 captive soldiers? It matters because the fate of my husband, Jonathan Pollard, is the miner's canary of the moral health and welfare of the people of Israel. A state that first betrays and then abandons its own agent for more than 2 decades and then relegates him to the dustbin of history while it moves on to other exploits is a state that is morally bankrupt. And a state that is morally bankrupt will never be able to fulfill its people's highest national aspirations, nor will it ever be capable of commanding the kind of moral resolve needed to bring its captives home. As Jonathan himself recently wrote in a letter to the families of the 3 newly captured soldiers, and I quote, fighting for the return of a captive requires a moral basis. It requires a commitment to God, country, and fellow man. It requires the kind of morality that the state of Israel no longer seems to have. When there is no moral basis for the return of a captive, wrote Jonathan, there is, of course, no moral resolve, no determination to succeed, and as a result, no effective action is taken. This creates a vacuum which the politicians love to fill with empty words and empty promises. While we cannot say for certain when the state of Israel first became detached from its moral roots and the people from our commitment to each other, we do know that the moral decay was there 21 years ago when Jonathan was thrown out of the Israeli embassy in Washington and into the waiting arms of the FBI. That moral failure, that ongoing sin against the loyal son of Israel who served the state and its people, has gone unchallenged and unrepaired for 21 years. It hangs like a curse over the nation. It spawned the abandonment of Ron Arad, Zachary Bummel, Shvi Feldman, Yudah Katz, and Guy Hever. It bred the callous abandonment of Mudchat Yosef, who was wounded on the field of battle and left to bleed to death at Kever Yosef in Shechem. It is the same moral failure that conceived and implemented the inhumane expulsion and destruction of Gush Katif and Northern Shomron, and more recently facilitated the abandonment of all of the citizens of Northern Israel. It is the same moral failure which has given birth to a culture of empty words and broken promises, which subsequent governments of Israel have perfected to a high art. It is the same moral failure which now threatens the lives of Gilad Shalit, Ehud Regev, Eldad Regev, and Ehud Goldwasser. As long as we allow Jonathan to continue to rot in prison, and we act as if his fate is of no consequence to us, the poison will continue to seep into our national consciousness and continue to destroy the fabric of our society as a moral and just people, as a light unto the nations. As long as we do not rectify the problem at its root by bringing Jonathan home, this culture of abandonment will continue its relentless onward march, as the government openly plans for the next round of uprooting, betrayal, and abandonment of its loyal citizens and communities. You may have come here tonight to be entertained, or perhaps you came because the subject was of interest, or you may have come because you always come when there's a program at the show, at the Knesset HaNasid. But if my message has reached your heart, you must leave here tonight knowing that each of us owes a debt of gratitude to Jonathan, and that each of us bears a personal responsibility for his fate. Redemption of Israel's longest-held captive, Jonathan Pollard, cannot help but lead to redemption for all of Israel and for all of her captives, for it lies at the heart of the matter. No one single person can save Jonathan, but each of us has something to contribute. Not a single person is exempt from doing whatever he or she can, be it prayer, both public and private, or hanging Pollard balcony banners, or participating in activities to raise the public profile of the case, or contributing to the activities of the committee to bring Jonathan Pollard home. They are the only group in Israel totally coordinated with Jonathan, and the head of the committee, Nissan Ganor, is here with us tonight in his nice Pollard t-shirt. Or supporting the National Council of Young Israel's deeply appreciated efforts to assist Jonathan with his needs in prison. Even at this late date, 21 years into his incarceration, nearly 22, I urge you all to become involved, as much for your own sake as for that of Jonathan and the nation. And every person here has family, has friends who are not here tonight, who need to know about this, who need to know that they're personally involved. That's a message that you're personally being charged with carrying back tonight to the family, friends, neighbors, the rest of the congregation, the people who didn't come tonight? I'd like to conclude with a quote again from Jonathan's letter to the families of the captive soldiers. And he says, "We cannot, we must not allow this culture of abandonment to go on. The people of Israel must find the emotional strength to return to the path of Aravut Hadadit, mutual responsibility. We must rekindle and recapture our strength as a nation that stands united, and as a nation that has at its root the moral resolve necessary to be utterly committed to never surrendering to evil, and to absolutely never abandoning a brother in time of trouble. If we can do this," writes Jonathan, "and I believe we can, then we may once again be worthy of the blessing of heaven, as we were at Entebbe, and we may be worthy of the swift return home of all of Zion's prisoners. May God bless us all, and may we all soon see the speedy release of Jonathan, Gilad, Eldad, and Ehud, along with all of Israel's captives and MIAs. Amen."
We will take a number of questions. However, we'd like whoever is going to have to ask a question come up here, because we do not have the portable microphone functioning this evening. We have Mr. Gal-Or over here, who is the representative of this Beit Knesset, who is a representative on the Pollard Committee, and he's a member of this Beit Knesset Hanasi, Yisrael HaTzair. And if you have any activity that you want to get involved with, get in touch with him, and I'm sure he'd make good use of you. Go ahead, let us shake.
I thank you for coming to speak. As someone who uses the medical system here, I would advise you to become a citizen. You'll have back to the medical all you want and all the drugs. Those are my questions. I want to know if Rafael Khan was ever investigated since he became a millionaire, wasn't on Jonathan's information, and two, has Caspar Weinberger's letter ever been made public?
I think you have three questions there, actually, so if I forget any, some will remind me. I think you have three questions there. Let me first of all respond to what you're saying. I think I might have felt a little bit differently if he'd come forward and said, you know what, my husband's a doctor, and he'd love to help you out. You know, for 21 years, let me finish, you asked your question, and I'm going to respond to it. In 21 years, and in all the years that I've been talking about the fact that I'm a cancer survivor and that I have no health coverage, that has never happened. Not one single person, even when I did the hunger strike here in 1994 and spent 2 months starving, I had no health coverage, and not a single doctor came forward and said, "Hi, I'm a doctor." And guess what? Israel has the highest per capita rate of doctors in this country. Not one single person ever came forward. But you came forward to tell me that I should become a citizen and da 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 da. And you didn't hear what I said. Even for money, they don't want to give me health coverage. Even for money, they ran away from Paula's wife. So, thank you for that piece of advice, but you have to understand that nothing in the Pollard case is as it seems, and there has not been, in 21 years, Tipat Rachamim from the government of Israel. There has been isolated cases, small instances of enormous Rachamim, such as, I am homeless, I have nowhere to live, we don't get any money, we don't have anybody to pay the rent. Some years ago, a Jerusalem widow, Bella Amiram, heard of our deep financial distress, and she offered me a room in her little apartment. And that's where I live. I live in a room in somebody's apartment. The kind of chesed that this represents, I can't even begin to describe, because I don't know where I would be otherwise. You asked about Rafi Khan.
By the way, another fabulous instance of chesed when we're talking about is Rabbi Pesach Lerner. Betrayal after betrayal after betrayal after betrayal by all the Jewish organizations in America, which if they would do nothing, okay. But it's what they're doing behind the scenes to sabotage and to hurt. And the only one in America, the tzaddik is Rabbi Pesach Lerner and his organization, the National Council of Young Israel. And I think you could be very, very proud of belonging to the NCYI synagogue, the Young Israel synagogue. Okay.
I'm very moved by your talk, and I would like to know if you've ever tried to contact Carolyn Boyce from the Jerusalem Post.
It's one person to ask who we haven't tried to contact. 21 years. Everybody thinks about Jonathan when they come to hear me speak, and some people think about him once a day for 5 minutes, and some people twice a day for 10 minutes, and some people, like Nissan or Eleonora, for hours and hours. But we think about Jonathan and I, and how to publicize his case. We think about it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There really isn't anybody that we haven't contacted, which is one of the reasons why I don't speak in public anymore. Because there isn't, by rights, there should be nobody who doesn't know already. Thanks.
Toby?
An old friend, why has there been such a conspiracy of silence? Why? What is the aim of Israel? What does it really want? What is its agenda? And what has happened in terms of the United States? There was one time an effort made from the Moriah others to do something. It faded away completely.
Your question is a very good question. The question really should go to people like Seymour. I did tell you about the letter of the conference.
I have the conference.
Alright. In 1987, they wrote to the State Department promising never to intervene on behalf of Jonathan, and they never have. Whatever posturing you may have seen was just posturing to the public. Every year, the Conference of Presidents is invited to go into the White House to discuss matters of mutual concern with the President. It's usually a working dinner, and the top, quote-unquote, top leaders in America are invited in. And they said, there is an official agenda. In the 21 years that Jonathan's been in prison, his name has never once been on the official agenda. And the operative word here is official. Because if it ain't official, it ain't happening. He has never once been officially put down by the Conference of Presidents as an issue of concern. I can also tell you that just to give you an example, in the year 2001, Jonathan got new attorneys, wonderful, wonderful fellows, Jack and Elliot, Jack Zimmerman and Elliot Lauer, who took the case back to court against all odds. In taking the case back to court, you have to understand that Jewish newspapers are as irresponsible as the leadership behind them. Most of the Jewish newspapers are Federation newspapers, so most of the Jewish newspapers, with the exception of whatever Toby was, tell you both months, they tell you what you want to hear. So, we repeatedly saw in Jewish newspaper things were written saying that Jonathan didn't have a good enough case to bring back to court. That was nonsense. The substance of Jonathan's court case was never heard. Every time his lawyers, Jack Semmelman and Elliot Lauer, filed, they were filing simply to get permission to come back to court, because we were still stuck with the same initial problem from the original lawyer that was paid by Israel to disallow Jonathan to have any appeal of his life sentence. So every appeal was simply a technicality now to just let us be heard. And the government held sway. The court backed the government by saying, you're too late. Stay in prison forever. The government again and again used technicality to shelve Jonathan. There was a certain point in this process that our attorneys, Kelly Lauer and Josh Semmelman, prepared a very detailed personal presentation for the elite of the American Jewish Leadership, the Conference of Presidents, and devoted an entire evening explaining in detail what was going on with Jonathan and what the risks were to the American Jewish community this love because of what they were letting happen to Jonathan. And they asked the conference to take several very simple steps. Things like to write a letter to the president. Well, that meeting, I believe, took place in the year 2002, 2003, something like that. Nothing that they requested was done, and nothing has been done by the conference since then. So the conference can never say that they didn't know, and Mr. Seymour Alexander never said that he didn't know. They know, but they're lockstep with Israel. Not because Israel's telling the American leadership what to do, but because for the American leadership, Israel's unwillingness to have Jonathan home is a good excuse for them to do nothing. And we are watching Jonathan slowly bleed to death in front of our eyes, and turning our backs, welcoming that leadership here when they come here, voting for substandard leadership here. And heaven watches and waits and weeps.
Just one comment. When we went up with Rabbi Pesach Lerner, like Esther said, he frequently visits Jonathan in jail. He said, he made one short statement. To free Jonathan, all that has to be done is that the state of Israel formally requests his release. So, Abel?
If I recall correctly, at the time of the Y agreement, former United States President Clinton was reported to have agreed to release Jonathan. Can you clarify for us exactly what occurred at that time?
Just to explain at length what happened in Y, is a 2-hour, hour lecture. So I'll try to just basically tell you where you can find the information, and I'll give you what you need right now. Anyone who has access to the internet, our website in English is www.jonathanpollard.org. It's really easy to remember, jonathanpollard.org. Just remember that Jonathan is spelled with two A's. And when you go to jonathanpollard.org, there is a page called the Y Double Cross page that has all of the articles. And probably the seminal article that I would read if I wanted to really know what happened at Y, I would read Terror. It's called Terror in the U.S. and the Jonathan Pollard Case, that explains everything that happened at Y. Let me briefly answer your question. Very briefly, on the Y Double Cross page on the internet, there's an introduction, and the introduction includes a quote from the Knesset protocol, where former Cabinet Secretary Danny Nevet states that the commitment by President Clinton to free Jonathan at Y was a commitment between two nations, not between two individuals, and that the commitment still stands. And that is in fact the case. President Clinton did commit to free Jonathan at Y. The price that Israel paid for his release, the only reason that Clinton agreed was that Israel agreed for the first time in its history to free murderers and terrorists with blood on their hands. That had never happened before. The original release was going to be 350 terrorists, none of them with blood on their hands, and in the end the Arabs proposed 750 if Clinton would throw in Pollard. And Clinton agreed to the Arab proposal, not even Israel. a long story. So 750 murderers and terrorists were freed, and Israel simply never bothered to collect them on the police. It's the same thing that I told you earlier. If you go to McCullough and you pay for a bag of flour and you pay 5 shekels for it, and you go home and it's not in your bag, then you're going to sit still and you're going to go back. And even if you're not going to yell at the guy from the McCullough, you're going to take him aside very quietly and say, oh, yes, I paid for this. Where is it? The only way for Jonathan to still be there after the Wyatt Court is for the state of Israel not to end.
I'm an ex-English teacher, and I believe this fact that we just heard, Clinton's honesty, Clinton working behind the scenes to make us, in the end, release hundreds of terrorists who have government hands, this can be and should be broadcast. I'm an ex-English teacher, and I'm not too old to get it out because I have in the high level as well. So I believe we've come to the most important fact of this evening. This whole story can be released to the Jews of America and from the Jews of America to the Jews worldwide. But don't forget, we only have 4 or 5 streams of Judaism in the world today. You have the Reformed Jews, who are the most liberal, but also the most non-practical.
Can I respond to you?
4 or 5 main streams of Judaism in the world today: Reformed Jews, Conservative Jews, Orthodox Jews, and secular Jews. And the secular Jews come in all kinds of shades.
Thank you.
Across the whole world.
But thank you for naming them for me. I appreciate that. Because all of the streams of Judaism and their respective leadership all signed letters to the president years ago, calling for Jonathan's release, which they did for their respective membership. And then they buried the letters. They never did anything with them. They didn't publicize them. They didn't take them to the White House. So in terms of telling the story of what happened and why, I guess you know, in this electronic age, you really need a computer and you need to be media savvy. The Y story is a very old story, and Dennis Ross wrote about it in his book, The Missing Piece. So it's very publicized. We've got to let somebody else ask the question. Thank you.
I have a question.
At the same time the power situation was going on, there was another case, if I recall correctly. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't remember it. But there was a case where somebody had stayed secret about the submarine at that time, and he was either got 7 years suspended or he was completely cleared. Why don't the lawyers at that point use that as a comparison? Why should this man be incarcerated so many years as opposed to what happened to this this other man? I don't remember his name.
But there was whatever
his name. But it has to be a balance.
You have to be able to get back into court to make that case. Every appeal that we've made was to try and get back into court. And we have far more compelling issues to deal with than simply comparative sentencing. And we could not get back into court at all because the government lent its weight to sabotaging all of Jonathan's legal appeals. Let me tell you something more interesting, though. The questions bring up an interesting fact. 4 months after Jonathan's arrest, there was an arrest here in Israel, which you've never heard of. An IDF officer named Yossi Amit was arrested here on espionage charges. He was fined for the United States. 4 months after Jonathan was arrested, spying for Israel. An IDF officer is arrested here, spying for the United States. What's the obvious thing to do? Exactly, a spy plot. We have on our website also an entire page of various Israelis who have spied for the United States, and Israel turns a blind eye, couldn't care less, and has left Jonathan Langwood. Yossi Amit was arrested in secret by Israel because they didn't want to make any fuss to bother the Americans. He was tried in secret, and he was incarcerated in secret, and he was released in secret after some 7 years. At no time did Israel ever try to use Amit or any of the other spies for the United States to secure Jonathan's release.
שלום, אני מדבר בעברית, אוקיי? אני בטוח עצמי יותר... אוקיי, תראו, אני בן 21 ואני רוצה לראות את הזמן שג'ונתן הוא בפריזן ואני חושב על הימים שאני גדלתי and he was in jail and stuff. אני והחברים שלי לומדים באוניברסיטה העברית, ומנסים להכין את התודעה את העניין של ג'ונתן, ומנסים לחלק כמאמרים קצרים, רק שאנשים יראו, ואני לא אגיד שזה עובד הכי טוב, כי אתם מכירים את התימות של החברה שלנו, זה לא משהו שהוא חדש. העניין הכי שרציתי להגיד הוא שאני חושב שיש פה עניין שאנשים עדיין לא כל כך יקלטו את זה, וזה לא שהממשלה לא יכולה לשחרר אותו. היא יכולה לשחרר אותו כמו שחררו את הזמן וכמו שחררו את מי שהם רצו. העניין הוא שיש פה לדעתי סוג של שחיתות, סוג של סוד, שאם יחשפו את זה, אנשים בתוך הממשלה, אנשים חשובים כביכול ייפגעו.
לא משהו חדש אבל.
When you say if you believe that it's not that the government can't free Jonathan, they can if they want to, just like they free this island or anyone else that they want to free. But he believes that there's some kind of corruption here and something secret, that if Jonathan is released, that secret will be revealed. That's not true. Okay? It's not that Jonathan knows anything about somebody that suddenly will be revealed. Okay? Actually, let's...
Not that he knows it, but that... אנשים בתוך הממשלה או שהיו בממשלה יודעים דברים והם דירכו את כל העניין הזה.
זה יכול להיות חלקי. אני אגיד לך דוגמה. אתה מבין באנגלית אם אני אגיד לך. A very good example was given by Eleanor Shiffrin, our representative to the Russian community. A very quick, short answer, and she answered somebody who asked me, why don't they want Jonathan home? Two issues. Number one, the people who are in government today, who are wearing all the top hats for the government, are the same characters who were there 21 years ago. They may be a changed hat, but they're all the same characters. And the answer Eleonora gave is, these are the same people who have been sabotaging Jonathan and stabbing him in the back for 21 years. If you were stabbing someone in the back, would you want to bring him home? Would you want to invite someone you stabbed in the back into your home? That's the only thing that will be revealed, is the shechitut of why they left him there to rot for 21 years. A good point, by the way, is that anything that begins with a lie is very difficult to rectify. And this whole case started with a lie that Israel pretended that they didn't know Jonathan, they didn't know about him, and he was a renegade. Let me tell you something. One of the things that Jonathan did, and this was in one of our bagatzes, One of the things that Jonathan did is he handed over to Israel the information to destroy PLO headquarters in Tunis. Anyone here remember the attack on Tunis? They got the information from Jonathan Pollard. Now, here you have prime ministers and all cabinet ministers, defense ministers saying, oh, we never knew about Pollard. We innocent, innocent. We knew nothing. Yet, they sent out the Air Force and endangered pilots' lives to blow up the headquarters of Tunis. A smock what? On the basis of what? On the basis of very reliable information. Well, how did the Prime Minister and the Defense Minister know this information was reliable? They knew because they knew the source. They knew it was coming from Jonathan Pollard, who worked for Naval Intelligence in Washington. Every single one knew, up to the top, including the head of Amman, Israel's military intelligence, who signed all of Jonathan's tasking orders. And who was the head of military intelligence at the time? Does anyone know? Do you remember? It was Ehud Barak, who went on to become Israel's prime minister, and the first prime minister to not even pretend that he wanted Jonathan home. Up until Ehud Barak, they used to pretend that they wanted Pollard home.
I feel as though this is a very naive question, but I would like just a very simple as possible answer. Why do all of the Israeli government and Americans as well want Jonathan dead? What is the simple answer here? Why do they want Jonathan dead?
My answer to that is always that you have to ask the people who are directly involved. But you have to also understand that it's a way that our government solves the world problems. Okay, it started with Jonathan, and when the wrinkle in the ointment for them with Jonathan was me. They never in their wildest dreams dreamed that Hashem would send him a wife when he was held 3 stories underground behind 13 rocks and keys. And the hysteria of when they found out that his wife could speak Hebrew was horrible. They did everything to try and sabotage us. They published that we're not really married. They published that Israel did everything they possibly could to cast questions, to call into question. You know something? I'll be very honest with you. When Lucifer asked me to speak, I said yes because I didn't think that they would let me speak here. Because there have been so many years of slander against us. This is a very upstanding synagogue, very, middle class, upstanding, financial, many in the United States, and very often, they're the first ones who heard all of that stuff, and we're not going to let her speak there, not that hilarious. Why? That was slander propaganda from the government of Israel. Rona Rad, why did they give up take Obed and Durani? Easier to keep him dead than to try and bargain for him. Right? And by the way, Nifan Dano, the head of the committee to bring Jonathan Pollard home, pointed out to me the big rally that was just held in Tel Aviv for our 3 captive soldiers. What was that all about? Nifan makes rallies also. Nifan and Eleonora, hi guys. And they put in weeks and months of blood, sweat, and tears. And we don't turn out thousands like that. The way that you turn out that kind of crowd is when you've got government money and government intervention quietly behind the scenes. Why is the government so interested in making hoopla for the missing soldiers? So that people can come and feel better that, look, I did something for the missing soldiers. I was at the rally. What are they doing really to bring them home? Well, they're just making rallies. The same way that they fly airplanes with balloons over Ronarat's house once a year.
You
have answered your question. They're just making up.
The group that has the greatest clout with President Bush right now and the Republicans are the Christian fundamentalists. Have they shown any interest in helping Jonathan?
Thank you for that question. Yes, they have. Yes, they have. And we've had outreach to the Christian fundamentalists, to some of the most fundamental fundamentalists, some of the AAs. And their bottom line to us always is, we are not going to do more than Israel is going to do. We cannot do more than Israel is going to do, which means we're going to do nothing. And whether that's, you know, I can name you the names afterwards. But again, remember, these guys meet with Israeli officials all the time. And Jonathan's simply not on the agenda. And when he's on the agenda, they're being told to forget it. And I met with two senior senators, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, not so long ago. And the one in the morning said to me, wow, this was a senior senator who was a known friend of Israel. He said, I've been on the Hill, I've been on Capitol Hill, what did he say at the time, 17 years? He said, in all these years, no Israeli official that I've met with, and I've met with many, has ever mentioned your husband to me. I didn't know anything. And in the afternoon, I met with another senior senator, who, again, a strong friend of Israel, who told me, Mrs. Pollard, I used to be an advocate for your husband's release, but no more. No more? Why not? What changed? Until you can get Israel behind this, leave me out. I can't do anything.
I'd like to thank Mrs. Pollard for coming down. We really, really appreciated her coming down here and telling everybody all about what I'm sure many of them didn't know. I'd like to take this opportunity, to the ladies especially, to announce that on Wednesday the 13th and at 12:15, there'll be another session of Skara for Rebbetzin Wine, and this time the speaker is Rabbi Macy Gordon. So please make your arrangements. Come down next Wednesday at 12:15. Again, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming down here. Good night.
Do you have email?
What a great thing.
Thank you.
Wow, what a great thing. I would like to pass it on to my kitchen in London.
Would you have email?
We don't need people. God will help us. Email. Get out of here.
Send me an email. Do you write down an address?
I have email in London.
Anyway, this is Christine here from Marie. There'll be a million in a few minutes.
Can I contact you at all and get your email?
Both the Tunisian. Tunisian.
Esther,
who was Prime Minister when he was at
the It was the National Unity Government, so it was Peres and Shamir.
That's what I think.
Mm-hmm. This is true that President Clinton was about to release him, and then when Monica Lewinsky's case happened, then he could release him.
Who?
President Clinton.
No. He was going to release him, and then
the security agents supposedly came to him.
The reason that Bibi was first promised Jonathan at Y was that he agreed to come to Y just prior to the House elections. So that gave Clinton a PR victory. He looked good to the public. So it was very good for Clinton at Y. Everything.
Well, I went to a meeting with the Pita. Mr. Lanton. With Mr. Lanton, you know. And that is what it was said, that President Clinton was about to be leaving, and then Monica Lewinsky.
No.
It wasn't even, they tell a lot of lies just to make it easier. They lie.
government has to be proud of. It's very weak now. It is weak. This is the time.
I should know.
That's the only thing I want to say. This is the time because they are going through a big crisis. God bless you. God bless you. Thank you for coming. There's so much to say, but now is the time, because the government is going to release 300 prisoners.
Tell me, there's nobody at home to talk to. They don't trust one. So,
what about one more hope? What about getting to Judge A. Lund, Benny A. Lund first? No, no way. Okay. I believe you.
You know what? There isn't a single person that you're talking about that doesn't know that Israel has an agent in prison 21 years, nearly 22, who is bleeding to death, really bleeding to death. I don't have to even remind them. I don't think so.
I'm just saying that Judge A. Lund.
So you speak to him. Somebody else is speaking. He doesn't need a reminder. He doesn't know. He's not an Israeli.
He knows.
Nobody needs.
He knows. But
what is going on is an institutionalized kind of hitnaru.
It's the first, because nobody wants to say that.
And so they need Esther Powell to run and tell them. Sorry, I don't do this anymore. Let me say. Go on. you haven't changed the way. That's not your way. And he's driven everybody crazy. He's driven, he's bothered the lawyers. He's bothered the lawyers in the States. Anyone who will talk to him about it, our office in Toronto. Then when it didn't work, so he starts slandering me. He joined forces with Barry Hamish to say very bad things. They're both a little bit strange. I have a very good
ready to take it abroad anymore.
Can I meet you and speak to you 5 or 10 minutes this week or so?
I don't do that at all.
Can I speak to you tonight?
No. You know what?
Let me tell you some important things.
I want you.
Regular custom. Maybe the regular custom.
Hi, how are you?
I make a few remarks.
But I have a question. You're not a citizen. That's why you can't get medical.
How do you know what my status is?
Because you would have answered my friend that I...
You don't know what my status is, and you don't... And what I did try to explain more than once is that things with Pollard are far more complicated than what they look like.
I understand.
Okay? Thank you.
But I think you're entitled to being a Jewish person and entitled to citizenship, and then you would get all your medical coverage.
That's what you think, and that is the way it is. The way things work normally, by the way, and again, I gave you an example tonight. When the government of Israel wanted to extend help, it was able to extend help not only to Tannenbaum's wife, but also to his mistress, excuse me. She didn't have to go and wait the mistress to declare what status she is or she isn't. And also to the Lebanese enemies. When the government of Israel wants to, it's able to do things very quietly. Azam Azam's family was funded for the entire 8 years that he was in prison. Okay? So what part of they treat Paula differently do you not get?
So you as his wife, they're refusing your citizenship.
We're not going there. That wasn't part of my discussion.
No. That's why I want to understand. That's one of the things that you don't have to under, you don't have to understand the details. You simply have to understand that if it were as simple as you were saying, what am I stupid that I don't know that if I become a citizen that I could get coverage, that they would be forced to.
And I have 1 minute of your time.
I'm afraid I have to steal her.
Okay.
She said, "Well, I'm coming." Thank you. We don't have to hope. We have to do things. We have to do things that Hashem will understand that we want to. Right now, Hashem will stand and he sees that.
Can I ask a simple condition? Do you have any kind of a condition structure
for this evening with that? On purpose, no. Because then people say, "I signed for college," and they go, "What?" And on purpose, I told Nisa not to bring a kupa tonight, so that people can put in their 2 cents and say, "I did for college," because that's not enough.
I went with Rabbi Goldman, that's what I mean. I followed at that time.
drove him there because he came for a visit specifically.
At that time he was in the Knesset.
At that time he was in the Knesset.
Oh, then I called him
from Canada. He might be able to do something. Yes, he was incarcerated in
Pennsylvania. Wait, it wasn't Pennsylvania. It was, no, it wasn't Pennsylvania.
I'm sorry.
No, it wasn't Pennsylvania.
Where was he?
At the beginning.
His aunt was, I picked him up in Pennsylvania. His aunt was in Pennsylvania. Nothing came of it anyway, but you're using the crutch.
Yes, I think of what you're saying.
Yeah.
21 years
ago. I know,
yes.
I know.
I'll write it down for you at some point.
I think we're being taped now on this.
You're fine. That's doing something. Also.
But you know what it means to have our...
It's a star.
I wish I could help you. I mean, you're invited to my apartment anytime. I
have a lot of horror about it. She's...
And the old girls don't know how exciting it is for you.
Thank you very much, but...
She said this before, it's just crazy. Like, it's crazy. The whole thing's crazy and nothing makes sense. And everything doesn't make sense. And that's what makes it even crazier. It just seems... I feel bad saying this to you. It's like so hopeless. I feel like there's nothing to do with it.
The bottom line is that only Hashem is going to be and he makes us. But he has given us 21 years to be his partner in his redemption. Why? To redeem ourselves by helping Jonathan and getting Jonathan out. We end up earning our own redemption. We end up becoming the people that we become. What Hashem wants is for people to care the way you care. And they don't. Right now people
are watching us. I mean, they feel terrible. No, I'm sorry. You have to answer. They're not public things for you to discuss. And like the way people spoke to upstairs, like that's horrible. I want to get up there and catch up for you.
You
are very sensitive and they think just to make sure
you
favorite
you can react the way you
do.
Jonathan would be home.
Exactly, that's what I was trying to tell her.
Because see, this is the whole point.
Everyone.
Everybody else, most of the people, they hear the same story and go home to their business.
But I'm still going to go home and still have to go to do anything.
Yes.
That doesn't feel like anything either.
So instead of feeling hopeless, then use your tears to pray.
Yes.
העונש הממוצע בעד מה שהוא עשה זה שנתיים עד ארבע שנים. עוד מעט יהיה 22 שנה. ואתה רוצה לשפר את
זה. וזה בגלל הרשות
הישראלית ש... הוא לא סתם סיכל את יונתן בלי הוראות. הוא קיבל את ההוראות מישראל.
כמה?
הוא סיכל את...
מה אזרח קטן כמוני יכול כאילו לעזור בעניין הזה? אני יכול להפיץ את זה כמה שיותר אנשים.
מאוד חשוב להפיץ, מאוד חשוב להתפלל. יש גם פעילות של הבד למען יונתן פועלת שאני כאן איתנו.
כן, אני מחבר שם באתר וכל זה בפורום מדברים ומדברים ושיחות.
אם תוכל,
and let's pray that Hashem will shine properly on your husband and all of Am Yisrael have a better year.
By the way, the income from the gig has come out. We had this year, earlier, last year, right by the
21 years in prison.
Huh?
21 years in prison.
We had a big Hafkana happen on
Yeah. 21 years, marking 21 years in prison.
Did anything come of
that? There's nothing. The only thing that should be a result of anything. The point I was trying to make tonight was when they made the big Hafkana in Tel Aviv now, Hafkanot are Hafkanot. They don't do anything. They make people feel like, look, I came and I kind of fear. As long as the government does nothing, it's not going
to be.
Because those in power have decided they want to be done. Hashem has his own agenda. Hashem will decide. The government, yes, but Hashem has a different agenda. And that's why when I came here tonight, I didn't get it.
Okay.
That's why when I came here tonight, I didn't want, I told my son not to give the box of that. I told him not to give small things, because I didn't want people to go away with the feeling. I did come in the call because I heard it from all the folks who gave you the box. Everyone has to go away and say, what can I do? That's one thing. And there's prayer. There's public prayer.
How many union names do you know of members play and you should be able to go?
Usually some of them say he's got all the activities. And he's son is the head of the committee to bring Jonathan Dolly home. And he's the one who's the first day home.
Jonathan Gaines. The Israeli government information that the United States is supposed to have given us.
Yep. Because it was all information that was vital to our existence. It was all about warfare capabilities.
And it was the Osirak thing.
Osirak wasn't Jonathan. Tunis was.
Osirak
set the background for why Jonathan's operation was necessary. After Osirak, people like Phil Weinberger and Bobby Ray Inman decided that Israel was getting too independent. So they decided that they would cut the flow of information, of legal information. And so Israel was then being blindsided. She didn't know anything that was happening with
the... We didn't have satellites in those days.
Yeah.
Nachomi. God knows who Nachomi is. Is that easier? Is it the for Nachomi?
No, he's come.
No, he didn't come.
The guy
with my arm.
Oh, I thought they said
he's getting the whole conversation.
Yeah. The guy, oh, wow, I can't believe you remember. I forgot all about it.